the dramatic conclusion of his ceremony, he was forced to recite those words while holding a flaming, blood-stained tissue instead. The Gambino family hadn't bothered to get enough saint pictures to burn. Gravano's induction ceremony not only began with lies, it also ended with them. The boss reviewed for him the rules of American Cosa Nostra. No killing with explosives, no killing law enforcement, no killing other made men without official permission, no sleeping with another made man's wife, and no dealing in narcotics. As a general rule, the mafia did a good job following the first two rules. The American government would crush anyone who harmed innocents with explosions or killed law enforcement. But the promises not to kill made guys, bed their wives, or deal dope were lies. Gravano and his fellow mafia members routinely did all three. As my fellow prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald explained it, they were like the rules against fighting in hockey. On the books is a no-no, but still a regular feature of the game. The closely related Sicilian mafia had a different rule, one that highlighted the centrality of dishonesty to the entire enterprise of organized crime on both sides of the Atlantic. Newly inducted members were told they were forbidden to lie to another made member, called a man of honor in Sicily, unless, and this was a big unless, it was necessary to lure him to his death. I once questioned another government witness, Sicilian mafia killer Francesco Marino Minoia, about this rule. "Franco," I said, "that means you can trust me unless we are about to kill you." "Yes," he replied, confused by my question. "Men of honor may only lie about the most important things." The life of lies. The silent circle of ascent. The boss in complete control. Loyalty oaths. An us-versus-them worldview. Lying about things, large and small, in service to some warped code of loyalty. These rules and standards were hallmarks of the mafia. But throughout my career, I'd be surprised how often I'd find them applied outside of it. My early career as a prosecutor, especially my role in confronting the mafia, reinforced my belief that I'd made the right career choice. The law hadn't been an obvious route for me. Ultimately, I chose a career in law enforcement because I believed it was the best way I could help other people, especially those suffering at the hands of the powerful, the crime bosses, the bullies. I didn't know it at the time, but it's possible that a life-altering experience I had when I was 16 years old, with a gun literally pointed to my head, made that choice inevitable. The gunman didn't know I was home that night. He'd been watching through a basement window and saw my parents say goodbye to the figure lying on the floor of the family room, lit only by the television's light. He probably thought that figure was my sister Trish, but it actually was my younger brother, Pete. Trish had returned to college after fall break, and our youngest brother, Chris, was out at a Boy Scouts meeting. Minutes after my parents drove away, he kicked in the front door of our modest ranch-style house and headed straight downstairs. October 28, 1977, the day that changed my life, was a Friday. For most of the New York area, the prior few months were known as the Summer of Sam, when the city and its suburbs were gripped by a serial killer preying on couples sitting in cars. But for northern New Jersey, it was the summer and fall of the Ramsey Rapist. The attacker was named for the dozen attacks that had begun in a town called Ramsey. Our town, Sleepy Allendale, was just to the south. Hearing heavy steps on the creaking basement stairs and a low growl from our dog, Pete jumped up and moved out of view. But the gunman knew he was there. He pointed a handgun and ordered my brother to come out from his hiding place. He asked if anyone else was home. Pete lied and said no. At the time, I was a high school senior and a nerd, with few close friends. As if to prove it, I was home that night, finishing a piece for the school's literary magazine. It was to be a brilliant social satire of the cool kids, the bullies, and the suffocating peer pressure of high school. The piece was late and short on brilliance, but I had nothing else to do on a Friday night, so I sat at the desk in my little bedroom writing. In the basement with Pete, the gunman demanded to be taken up to the master bedroom. Shortly, I heard two sets of footsteps just outside my door, headed for my parents' room. Then I heard more sounds, as the closet and dresser drawers opened and closed. Out of annoyance and curiosity, I stood and opened the sliding wood door to the bathroom that connected my room to my parents. Their room was brightly lit, and through the bathroom I could see Pete lying on the side of the bed, his head turned toward me, but with his eyes tightly closed. I stepped into the room, looked to my right, and froze. A stocky, middle-aged white guy wearing a knit cap was holding a gun and looking in my parents' closet. Time slowed down in a way I've never again experienced. I lost my sight for an instant. It returned in a strange haze, and my entire body pulsed as if my heart had grown too big for my chest. Spotting me, the gunman moved quickly to Pete and put his knee in the middle of his back, using his left hand to push the gun barrel against my 15-year-old brother's head. He turned to me. "You move, kid, and I'll blow his head off." I didn't move. The gunman had angry words for Pete. "I thought you told me nobody else was home." The gunman then stepped off Pete and ordered me to lie on the bed next to my brother. Standing at my feet, he demanded to know where he might find money. I later learned that Pete had money in his jeans pocket as we lay there and never gave it up. I gave it all up. I told him every place I could possibly think of. Piggy banks, wallets, dollar coins received from grandparents or special events, everything. Armed with my leads, the gunman left us lying on the bed and went searching. A short time later, he returned and simply stood above us, pointing his gun in our direction. I don't know how long he pointed it without a sound, but it was long enough that the moment changed me. I was certain I was about to die. Hopelessness, panic, fear smothered me. I began to pray silently, knowing that my life was about to end. In the next instant, a strange wave of cold washed over me, and my fear disappeared. I began reasoning, thinking that if he shot Pete first, I would roll off the bed and try to grab the gunman's legs. And then I began to speak, to lie more precisely. The lies came pouring out. I explained how estranged we were from our parents, hated them, actually, didn't care what he took from them, wouldn't tell anyone he had been there. I lied again and again and again. The gunman told me to shut up and ordered both of us to our feet. He then began pushing us down the narrow hallway from my parents' room, pausing to search rooms and closets he passed. I was now convinced, temporarily at least, that I was going to live, and began trying to get a clear look at his face so I could tell the police about him. He jammed me in the back several times with the gun barrel, telling me to turn my head away from him. I again began talking, telling him over and over that he should just put us someplace, and we would stay there so he could get away. I began racking my brain trying to think of such a place in the house, a place where we could be locked.